All right, man, good morning. If you're still working on your mission statement, feel free to keep sketching that out as I start our talk this morning. We're continuing in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 through 9 this morning. I'll start by reading the passage. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, and the sincerity of your heart as to Christ, not by way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. With good will render service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. And masters, do the same things to them and give up threatening, knowing that both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. In this passage, Paul is continuing his instruction on household relationships. In chapter 5, he started talking about husbands and wives. Then he addressed parents and children in the opening verses of chapter 6. Now he addresses slaves and masters. It might not seem immediately apparent that he's talking about household relationships when he talks about slaves and masters, but in Paul's time, slaves were often part of households. And in the realm of Christianity, Christians were counted among both the slaves and the masters. So he's talking about these two groups of people, both groups containing slaves. Christians. Slavery has existed throughout most of human history, and it even persists today in certain corners of the world, but it's no longer part of our Western social structure. Even though our social structures have changed significantly, Paul's instruction continues to have some application to our employee and employer relationships, and that's what we're going to focus on this morning. But I want to acknowledge the fact that Paul's instruction to slaves can strike a pretty discordant note in the modern ear, and that's understandable. I mean, the bloodiest war that we Americans ever fought, we fought against each other. And the question at the core of that conflict was whether states had the right to permit or to outlaw slavery. Today, Americans of all political stripes view slavery as a horror that we would never want to revisit. So what do we make of the fact that Paul told slaves to obey their masters? He didn't condemn slavery as an institution. First, it's useful to distinguish the slavery of Paul's era from the slavery that we had in the United States up until the 19th century. Slaves in Paul's era were mostly citizens of conquered nation. They were conquered people. They didn't have the same divisions of socioeconomics and education and that sort of thing that characterized American slavery. The status of a slave in Paul's time was rarely mandated for life. Most slaves could expect to earn their freedom in about 10 years. And in an age of barbaric warfare, to become a slave was generally preferable to being slaughtered. And those were the alternatives. The legacy of American slaves is that they originated from the roughly 3 million Africans who were kidnapped, transported to the West, and sold into slavery between 1492 and 1807. That trade continued after 1807, but that's the last year in which it was lawful to import slaves into the United States. But that type of slavery, to kidnap people and sell them into slavery, that type of slavery was punishable by death under the Jewish law of the Old Testament. Paul describes kidnapping of that sort as sinful and ungodly in 1 Timothy 1:10. Paul also had very wise and practical reasons for not preaching directly against slavery. Historians estimate that there were 250,000 free people in Ephesus in the first century, and there were 400,000 slaves. Immediate emancipation would probably have resulted in vast economic upheaval, violence, and it would have served neither the masters nor the slaves. For much of history, the economic status of a slave whose economic needs were provided by masters was actually preferable to being a poor worker who often faced existential threat. Even Frederick Engels, the co-founder of communism, commented that the slave was assured of an existence while the poor worker was subject to the threat of starvation. Because of the irregular demand for labor. Thus, a slave could expect to have a better existence than a poor worker, a proletarian. So, although Paul didn't condemn the institution of slavery, it's also true that he never defended it. Paul taught that slaves should obtain their freedom if they could in 1 Corinthians 7. He taught that masters should view their slaves as their equals here in Ephesians 6 and in Galatians 3. He taught that masters should set their slaves free at the proper time in Philemon, verse 16. If you're unfamiliar with the book of Philemon, it's a very personal letter that Paul wrote to another individual, a Christian, who was a master. In connection, the topic of the letter was a runaway slave named Onesimus, who was also a Christian, had become a Christian since he had fled from that master. And Paul's letter was a calculated plea for Philemon to free his believing slave. Paul's ambition was not to reform this perverse structure in society through coercion, but to change the hearts of men, which would result in a radical transformation of every human relationship. And I make these distinctions, and it comes up in some similar passages, because these passages have a really unfortunate legacy of having been used to defend the institution of slavery in the United States in the 19th century. And we're going to face critics today who want to jettison the entirety of Scripture because of that legacy. Scripture always trumps tradition, but we need to be very, very careful not to defend an indefensible history. And when we defend Scripture, we should be scrupulous to defend what is truly scriptural. It's true that virtually every nation on earth gave protection to slaveholders in the 19th century, so the United States is not uniquely culpable in this, but that commonality of sin doesn't make it evil. Christians shouldn't have the reputation of defending the indefensible. We need to be prepared to distinguish what Paul is saying here from the evils that unfortunately some of these passages have been used to justify. Well, now, 153 years removed from our history of slavery, the closest analog we have here to this master-slave relationship is the employer-employee relationship. It has a very key distinction, which is that the employee is free to leave, and the employer has no lawful right to force the employee to keep working. It doesn't feel that way because most of us need the wages of our work to meet our daily needs. But we still have the legal right to terminate that relationship at will. Some of us, a limited set of us, have contracts and we're supposed to work out those contracts. But the consequence of breaking that contract is usually that you can't work for someone else, or it might cost you some money, but it's not going to cost you your freedom. So we live in a different era. But Paul first addresses slaves or employees here, and he tells them to be obedient to those who are their masters according to the flesh. Obedient. Those of us who are independent, modern people don't really like the word obedience. We kind of chafe at that notion. I'm not going to obey anybody except God. But the fact is that we often learn godly obedience through obeying other people. Children learn obedience from obeying their parents. We continue to learn obedience to God by being obedient to other people. But obedience by its nature means doing something that we wouldn't naturally do. By its nature, it means doing something that we don't want to do oftentimes. Sometimes it means doing things that we don't think are right or wise. Most of us who are employees have been in the situation of being told to do something that we're like, well, I wouldn't do it that way. I think that's the wrong path to go. But Paul is telling these employees, obey your masters. Not only obey, but do it with a cheerful heart. Do it with a willing spirit. There are boundaries to this call to obedience. We should not obey our employers if they ask us to do something that is disobedient to God. If there's a direct conflict between the instructions of our employer and the dictates of God, we serve the higher call. There's no question in that. Peter and John demonstrated that boundary in Acts chapter 4 when Jerusalem's rulers, elders, and scribes asked them to stop preaching. And Peter asked the rhetorical question. They said, well, we leave it to you whether it's right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God. The answer to that is obvious. So whether we're dealing with the government, whether we're dealing with our employer, if it directly conflicts with what God has called us to do, then we have to answer the higher call of God. But unless an employer's instruction violates the law of God, it's incumbent on employees to obey. If you're asked to obey your employer and you don't want to, and it's not violating the law of God, it's incumbent on you to find different employment if you can't obey your employer. And if we serve a non-Christian employer, it is all the more true. We have all the more reason to obey because the reputation of Christ and Christianity is bound up in the quality of our service. A few weeks ago, I talked about the theology of work. Paul's words here also relate to work. The emphasis here is on relationships at work. But I do want to reiterate some of the things that I said in the earlier talk. And if you guys were not here for that, you might pull it up. We've got the link on the church's website. But I'll summarize it for those who weren't here. I taught that Christians need to stop looking to their work as their source of provision, because God is our source of provision. And we need to stop looking to work to define our status or standing on this earth, because the pursuit of earthly status stokes our pride and it has no eternal value. But we do those things. I think we all struggle with those things. We do look to our work for our provision. We do look to our work for our status. The problem with doing that is that work becomes our idol, and it becomes an overbearing idol. It becomes an unforgiving idol. At the risk of sounding really self-important, I'm going to quote myself from that earlier talk. And it's breaking some rule of etiquette or style or something to quote yourself. But anyway, I'm going to do it, because it's really elegantly phrased. When work is our idol, our orientation is inherently selfish. We look to work to elevate us, esteem us, and provide for us. When we see work in its rightful place, which is a means through which we serve God and serve others, and we instead look to God for our identity, purpose, and provision, then we are free to enjoy work as God intended. Stated simply, we need to apply the two greatest commandments to our work. The greatest commandment is that we love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. The second is like it, that we love our neighbors as ourselves. Use your work as a platform through which you obey these commands, and you will both enrich others and enhance your own enjoyment of your work. Love, these two greatest commandments, is a thing that we neither give nor receive in isolation. There is an other that is involved with that. That other may be God, that other may be other people. But we only experience love in relationship. The primary source of love and the only perfect source of love is God. As Christians, we have to draw on that perfect love to then love the people around us. As Christians, we have to draw on God's perfect love to love our employers well. And Paul is saying here that we love well when we obey well. If we desire to be effective witnesses in our workplace, and I think most people want to be. I hear a lot of men talk about, how can I be an effective witness in my workplace? It's not just about apologetics or a clever turn of phrase. To be an effective witness in your workplace, you need to be an excellent employee at your workplace. We must not be the malcontent. We must not be the first to shirk, the first to complain, or the weakest link in the chain. We will be effective witnesses if we are excellent in serving our employers well. We have the freedom to choose what line of work we will pursue and which employees we will serve. So as we serve those chosen employees, we also have the responsibility to identify the skills for which we're suited, and the skills so that we can pursue work for which we're well suited. Unless we work with integrity, our employers are not going to see Christ in us, no matter what words we speak. Paul describes masters as those who are masters according to the flesh. According to the flesh. He's saying that our earthly roles of master and servant have no eternal resonance. If in this life you are subordinate to a Christian employer, manager, that has no resonance in the future as to what your standing in heaven is going to be. None. There's no analog in heaven for that relationship. But what does have eternal resonance is the way that we handle our relationships with other people on this earth. Paul's call to obey with fear and trembling is really referencing our fear and trembling before Christ, who we ultimately serve. We are to serve our earthly masters as though we were obeying Christ himself, because it's God, Christ, who has put our masters over us. We are to serve with sincerity of heart and not with a smile on our face and a heart full of contempt, because that heart is eventually going to come out of our mouths, and that's not a good witness at our work. Eye service, which Paul prohibits here, is to serve only when we think our employer is watching us. Why would we only work well when our employer is watching us? Well, it's because that advances our agenda. If we work well when our employer is watching us, it's like, well, that might help me out. It might help me advance. It might get me more money, keep me from getting fired, whatever. That reveals insincerity of heart. But we Christians serve a higher master who has instructed us to serve our earthly masters with the same sincerity of heart and dedication that we would give to God himself. We not only serve a higher master, but we have a higher call, which is to be ambassadors for Christ. Whatever it is you do, whatever your job is, whatever your vocation is, you are an ambassador for Christ. So when you go to work this morning, instead of dreading a day of boredom, stress, embrace the higher call of the Christian. In going to work every morning, you are serving your family, you are serving your employer, and most importantly, you are serving your God who has called you to this service. It is for God that you are ultimately working, and he who has placed you where you are. Embrace the nobility of your work. A lot of guys hate their jobs. It is to them a necessary evil, a thing that they would rather not do, and they really look forward to the day when they can stop doing it. I've been there. But as we talked about in the earlier talk, work is not a result of the fall. Work was implemented before the fall. Work is a good. But like the rest of creation, it is cursed. It is toilsome often. It is also, however, noble. Remember who you are ultimately working for. Embrace that nobility, and it's going to feel less like enslavement, and it's going to feel more like a platform for rendering service of eternal significance and for eternal reward. Paul encourages servants to be mindful that they are not working for an earthly reward, but for an eternal one. I mean, just get your arms around changing that mindset. I'm not going to work to earn a paycheck. I'm going to work to earn an eternal reward. Well, that kind of adds a layer of significance to what you do every day. Paul describes this day of repayment in 2 Corinthians 5:10, where he writes, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds of the body, according to what he has done, either good or bad." Jesus himself spoke of this day in Matthew 16:27, where he wrote, "For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and will then repay every man according to his deeds." So our hope in eternity is not rooted in the fleeting things of this earth. We're not hoping for what we're going to get here and now. But what we do here will resonate for eternity. Nothing we do for God's glory will be unrewarded. I have to remember that as a guiding principle. Nothing we do for God's glory is going to be unrewarded. It may be unseen here. It may be unacknowledged here. It may be ridiculed here. You may be punished for it here. But nothing you do for God's glory in whatever context is going to be unrewarded. That includes the way that we comport ourselves at work. Don't allow your work to become this siloed existence where the other principles of God do not apply. Live a life of integrity where they are all consistent. They're all together. In verse 9, Paul shifts his attention to the masters with a mirror command. And probably most of the guys in this room are in both of these roles. Most of us are both employers and employees. Even if you have your own business, you've got clients, you've got key customers, and that sort of thing, you're still answerable to. It still feels like you've got a boss. But Paul says, masters, do the same thing to them. In other words, Paul calls on masters to recognize that they are only masters with respect to the flesh. Paul's like, do the same thing to them. You're not really a better person than they are. You're not really more significant than they are. Remember that this role that you have is according to the flesh. The Christian master has no superior standing before God, and he has no higher place in the kingdom to come. He doesn't. The master-servant relationship is swallowed up in the church. Masters should treat their servants with due consideration, with respect, esteeming them and valuing them. This is true for non-Christian employees as well as Christian employees, and for the same reasons that we gave to employees earlier. The Christian employer has a tremendous opportunity to show the love of Christ to his employees by being gracious, patient, generous, unselfish. A Christian employer should see his employees as something more than a resource to create more revenue. The Christian employer must recognize the eternal significance of how he's handling these people. You're not just making a living. Your employees are human beings of dignity and worth. And some of the most disappointing interactions I've seen as a Christian, I've seen this too often, are Christian managers and the way they deal with their employees. Whether it's due to temperament or training, I've seen a lot of Christian managers who seem to view their status as something permanent, as if it's reflective of something in the kingdom. They treat their subordinates as if they were a different category of human being, whose ambitions, fears, and needs were something less than the manager's own. I wasn't going to say this, but I had a when I was an associate a long time ago, I had a partner and professed to be a Christian, and he actually trained me, taught me, he's like, with respect to our secretary, paralegal, he said, don't get to know these people. You don't want to get friendly with these people. Don't let them in. They're going to come and go. I mean, they're just like chattel. Just, you know, they're there for revenue. I mean, that was the instruction. That's the way I was taught. And you start to see people differently if you're trained that way. But these are human beings of inherent dignity, worth. They have the same stresses that I do. They mostly have families. They're going through the same sort of things. Christian managers should not be known for their contempt. For what could be less Christ-like than to have contempt in your heart for another human being? We should be known for our love. Now, Christian managers have to make the same hard decisions that any other manager does. Things like terminations, demotions, and pay cuts. This nature of this earth, and sometimes decisions like that need to be made. But even those difficult experiences can be taken captive for the kingdom if we handle them with grace and with integrity, being mindful of the people that we're dealing with and their significance. Paul specifically prohibits threatening by the Christian master. And I've known people, managers, who manage by threat and by fear. They use their anger like a bludgeon. This shouldn't be true of the Christian employer. And guys, it's not acceptable to simply say, as I've heard, well, that's just how I am, so if people want to work for me, then they need to learn how to deal with this. Your employees are going to have to endure a lot of things because they're going to want to keep earning a paycheck. A lot of them feel like they don't have a choice, but that doesn't sanitize your anger. In the eyes of an employee, particularly a non-Christian one, the power of an employer is fearsome. If you're an employer, don't lose sight of that. Your power is fearsome to them. At your whim, you can eliminate their ability to pay their rent, pay for their car, pay for their phone, and everything else that they need to live. It's a fearful thing to be in that position. The manager seems to hold the keys to the employee's financial and professional future. But men, remember that the people underneath your supervision are one of two things. They're either co-heirs with Christ, your brothers and sisters in Christ, or they're lost people in need of a Savior. Whichever they are, your role is to treat them with the love of Christ. Work itself is good, and it is not a consequence of the fall, but because of the fall, our work is often toilsome. It's hard. And you ask yourself, why is my work so hard? It seems like other people are having fun at their work. I'm not having fun at my work. But our work provides a venue that can either grow us in our faith or expose our lack of faith. The forces of this earth, the ethic of this earth, wants us to derive our sense of security and our perception of our own worth from our success or a failure at work. Do you notice how a lot of commentary on social issues and family issues, sort of career tends to bubble up to be like the highest thing, the noblest virtue? You know, you might get married, divorced, and you might have kids. They're going to go, but your career, that's really where you're going to derive your sense of worth and significance. It's out of whack. Work is noble. It is created. It is a good thing we are called to do. But it is not the source, even of our provision, and it's definitely not the source of our identity or significance. If we fall into the mistaken beliefs of this world that work is our security, is our significance, it's going to be impossible for us to fulfill these commands to masters and servants, because if we buy into the view of the world, it's very selfish. Instead, let's view our workplace as a platform to fulfill our higher call, which is service to Christ and to his kingdom. It doesn't matter what you do. There's no distinction between being a pastor and being a lawyer, as being what any of you guys are. We are all called to bring our faith into our workplace. All of us are serving God in what we do vocationally, or should be. My nugget this morning is, remember that God is your boss. Kind of put that in your head. Just remember that God is your boss. Wherever you work and wherever you do, God is your ultimate boss. God is our ultimate source of provision, and it is only his approval that ultimately matters. So work everywhere as if you're serving him. This means that we work with industry and integrity as if we're trying to please him. It means we strive for excellence in all that we do. It also means that when our earthly boss asks us to do something that's against God's law, I have a higher boss, and that's who I'm called to obey. God is our boss, and his standards trump the contrary standards of this earth. I think, TJ, you wanted to transition us here.
So continuing on this theme, I want to quote something that I said about 30 minutes ago. No, actually, what I want you to do is to grab those cards that you filled out at the beginning. We asked you to jot down what you see as your life purpose statement. And I'm curious, as you look them over, I'm curious if any of the following themes seem to resonate in there. If you saw these in as part of the makeup of your statement. Making an impact, pleasing God or doing His will, being someone who reflects Christ to the world around them, living out godly or Christ-like character, serving Him. These are all themes that we've spoke about, not only this morning, but if you think about it, over the last month, as we've walked through the end of chapter 5 and the beginning of chapter 6 of Ephesians. So here's a question. What are the most important environments in your world to live out what you wrote down on that card? What are the most important environments to live these out? I would imagine that the primary relationship or environment would be our homes, right? Because if we're not living these things out with the people that we're closest with, it's kind of backwards a little bit. We're probably missing the mark. But I would imagine the second most important environment to live out our mission statement is probably what we've been talking about this morning, our places of work. Because we've got strategic opportunities to be light in darkness, to make the impact that we want to have in our lives. But at the same time, in both of these environments, I think it's important to recognize that we face challenges every day to living these out. And as we go into our discussions here in a second that your table leaders are going to lead, I just wanted to remind us of a little of the backdrop that started the last 3 or 4 weeks of our teaching. Because before we got into this, the context of our relationships with our wives, with our children, and our work, Paul began all of that by talking about the fact that we need to be filled with God's Spirit. That if we're not first filled with God's Spirit, if we're dependent upon our own resources to live out the very thing you just put on that 3x5 card, it's not going to work. If it has eternal significance to it, we've got to depend upon God's empowerment in order to live out all of these relationships. I just wanted this to be a little of the backdrop for the conversations that we're going to have now around our tables. And just know that at the top of the hour, I'm not going to come back up here and close this out. We'll close out around our tables when we wrap up there.